Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Fagner. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Quit the Banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. Foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. We're coming to you live from East Tennessee tonight. The solar wind is a brisk 573 kilometers per second, and little sunspot 985 is making its way across the face of the sun. No risk for solar flares right now. In the news, the House Appropriations Committee moved the $186 million space-based radar program back into the hands of the Air Force. This is seen as a shift from the intelligence budget to the Air Force. Is there really any difference? And XM Radio has reported a 22% increase in revenues from a year ago. Perhaps now they're ready for BBS Radio to introduce the world's first paranormal channel. And don't forget to order your copy of the Inner Earth Expedition Part 1 in DVD. It's now for sale on Amazon.com and on our website at x2-radio.com. Also, we want you to remember to get out to Weed, California, August 8th through 12th for the ET conference. Go to ShalimarProductions.com to register. And also, please remember to make your way to the San Francisco Bay Area UFO Conference on August 25th and 26th. This is the one UFO conference you must attend this year. This is the granddaddy of them all, bigger than anything else in the country. Last week, we had two great guests. We had Freddie Silva, who came on and gave us remarkable new insights into understanding crop circles. I had no idea that the energy from a crop circle is left in the ground under it for years. I also didn't know that crop circles never repeat and never appear over the same site. It appears they may have been left in the earth below the crops for centuries before and simply come out to give us a message. We also had Jan Levin, a theoretical cosmologist who gave us a decent lesson in physics. Although she didn't step too far outside the mainstream box, she did help us understand a little better that the universe is finite, even though it's really big. Tonight, our guest needs almost no introduction. He has written at least two fantastic books. The two I know about are De-Evolution and Forbidden Archaeology. You can't read either one and sit still through a modern classroom without correcting the professor. He is a world-renowned lecturer and researcher on the subject of the origins of mankind. Please welcome with me Michael Cremo. How are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm just great, Brooks. It's really great to be with you and all your listeners on X Squared.
Well, we appreciate you. I'm going to let the phone lines open up, if my producer's listening, in the very first of the first hour, because Michael Cremo's also going to be at the San Francisco Bay Area UFO Conference. And I'm sure many of his regular fans would like to reach him tonight as they prepare for that conference. Here are the phone numbers, toll-free anywhere in the U.S., 877-876-5227. Anywhere toll-free in Canada, 888-810-8322. And anywhere else on the planet or off-planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-876-3222. Now, Michael, I have to say, from the very introduction of the book, De-Evolution, I was blown off my feet. Most of the people listening to this program have been indoctrinated that modern man came from apes, and Darwin is like the high priest of anthropology, and like Galileo, anyone who sees through to the naked buttocks of the emperor is discredited as being blind. I guess I'd really like to know how you got started on this phenomenal path of research into the origins of man.
Well, that has to do with a journey of self-discovery that I started when I was in my early 20s. Of course, I grew up in the United States, and I was pretty much on the conventional track, you might say, up to the time I went to the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. in 1966. But within a couple of years, I had become very disillusioned with the knowledge system of the modern university, and I thought there have to be other ways of getting at a more real truth. So I started looking around for other ways of knowing and other truths other than the ones that had been taught to me at the university. So I was led gradually to the systems of meditation and yoga that come out of India, and I became attracted to the teachings of one of the gurus from India. His name was Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and through him, I became interested in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, among which there's a group called the Purana, or the histories. And in these ancient histories, I read accounts of human civilizations that have existed for many, many millions of years on Earth. I found in them all kinds of descriptions of these ancient civilizations. So I began to wonder, well, if there's any truth to what these ancient writings are saying, there should be some physical evidence to back it up. So I looked in the current textbooks of anthropology and archaeology, but I didn't find any such evidence there. So I decided, let me look a little bit deeper. Let me go beyond the textbooks. Let me look at the original archaeological reports by the original investigators from the time of Darwin up to the present in all different languages. Fortunately, I've got a reading knowledge of most of the European languages, you know, like German, French, Italian, Spanish, Russian, and so on. I started that research to see what there might be there. And at first I thought, well, I do a few weeks of research, maybe write a short article, and then go on to something else. But as I got into the research, I found the 8 weeks turned into 8 months, and the 8 months turned into 8 years, because I was encountering so many reports of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, reports of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. So with Richard Thompson, I put all that material together in the book Forbidden Archaeology. And then from there, people began asking me, well, you've got all this evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins. What do you think is the explanation?
Yeah, it came from the very same reports that they made their claims from.
Yeah, and so then people started asking me, well, what alternative explanation for human origins are you going to propose? So that led to the book that you were mentioning at the top of the show here, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So when you started digging this up and you made your report, you wrote your first book, what did you think would happen when you published that book?
Well, I actually had in mind that I wanted to do two things. I wanted to start a dialogue within the scientific community itself about this evidence for extreme human antiquity. And I also wanted to reach out to the general public and let them know that what they had been taught in school and university was wrong, that human beings didn't evolve from apes, that we've been on this planet practically since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. So I had that in mind right from the very beginning when I was writing the book before it was even published. So I think on both counts I was able to succeed. There was a reaction from the scientific community. Now, as you might expect, some of that reaction was intensely negative. For example, Richard Leakey said about my book, it's pure humbug, nobody would take it seriously but a fool. But nevertheless, there were other scientists and archaeologists, anthropologists, historians of science, and philosophers who actually thought I had done a good thing. The book was reviewed in many of the professional journals of archaeology and history and history of science, and many of them were somewhat positive in the sense that they recognized nobody's really gone into this subject in this depth before. Nobody's really investigated the history of archaeology in such detail. So on that basis, I was able to get many invitations to speak at some of the leading scientific institutions in the world, like the Russian Academy of Sciences, the Royal Institution of London. I was also invited to speak at major conferences on archaeology, meetings organized by the European Association of Archaeologists, the World Archaeological Congress, and so forth. And I'm not saying that everybody who heard me agreed with me, but I think if ideas are going to change, you know, the very first step is that scientists have to be willing to listen to a new idea. Now, there are some scientists who don't want to hear me. They try to do everything possible to discourage people from listening to me. But there are some who have open minds. They are willing to listen to evidence. And among those who have heard me, there are some, a few admittedly, at this point in time, but that's how these things go, who actually agree with me. And as far as the general public goes, I was able to reach out to them. My books are now in over 20 languages, and I've gone to all of these countries and had, you know, very successful lecture tours and a lot of publicity in the press and media. And I would say most people in the world today actually agree with me. I would say
the same thing. I mean, and just reading your book, it sounds so common sense to me. One of the questions that comes to me very early on in the book, as I'm getting into it, I realize how controversial it is, and I realize in my own science of physics, we routinely throw out data that does not fit the general paradigm. I didn't realize that it also happened in archaeology. Archaeology is a fascinating science of pure discovery. Did you have a mentor that sort of helped you question the foundations of archaeology with some credibility and allow you to get your foothold?
Well, I would say my main mentor was my spiritual teacher, you know, Bhaktivedanta Swami, because I had never encountered anyone in my life or education who had such a clear insight and who was so unafraid of speaking out against the scientific mainstream. I've never encountered anyone like that, because we have these days a tendency to put scientists on a pedestal. I mean, if we look at the media, for example, we'll see the media, they're always willing to question a politician or the head of a corporation or a general or a religious figure like a pope or something. They're doubtful and skeptical about everybody except scientists. You know, somehow or other, scientists to a large degree have escaped the normal kinds of critical scrutiny and skepticism that we apply to practically every other category of personality in the world. We don't just accept without question what a politician tells us. We doubt. We say, well, maybe they're not telling the truth. So I found my spiritual teacher's approach to science really amazing, because he was willing to question, are they telling us the truth? Maybe we're not getting the truth from them. I would also say I think I learned some things from my Forbidden Archaeology co-author, Richard Thompson, who was also a student of the same teacher, but a professional mathematician. And he had some interesting insights as well. And then over the years, as I've gone through the research and gone through the outreach, and I've encountered many scientists and students of science and ordinary people throughout the world, I think I've learned a lot. Every time I go on a radio show like this, I learn something from somebody, yes, from some of the callers. I really do. So for me, it's a constant learning process, and I've got some inspiration, insight, and mentoring from many different people.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned that your main mentor was more or less a spiritual teacher, and he kind of helped you do what we scientists are supposed to be doing, and that's questioning things and maybe making assumptions about things that we really don't have the answers on, to try to reach out there. But in your beginning thoughts, you faced a question that most everyone asks: where did humans come from? But you came up with a better set of questions that perhaps guides us to new realms What are those three questions that you have?
Well, I think you're right. When I was doing the work on this book, you know, Human Devolution, I was trying to answer the question that people always have, where did we come from? I thought, when I started thinking about that, I began to realize there were some other questions that had to be answered first before we got into that one.
Right.
And there were two questions that came to my mind, really, that I think we need to answer first. What is a human being? And who are we? Where did we come from? These things, I mean, before we get to those latter questions, who am I and where did I come from, I think we have to ask, what is a human being? Because that's going to determine the way you're going to answer the questions. For example, today, most scientists, they think a human being is simply a very complex combination of atoms. That's what they think we are. We're a purely material, biological machine. That's what a human being is. There's nothing more to it than that. So if you think that a human being is just a very complex organization of matter, then when you start to try to answer the question, where did human beings come from? Well, you start looking for, okay, simpler organizations of matter, you know, going back to the original situation of the Earth where you just have chemicals,
yeah,
you know, floating there.
The
and then you decide, well, how did those chemicals combine together to form the first living thing? And then after you have the first living thing, how do those chemicals further modify themselves in biological form until you get the human being?
Right.
So I thought, well, to me, that assumption is the first thing that needs to be challenged, that a human being is simply a combination of ordinary matter, simply a complex organization of chemicals, really. So when I look at all of the evidence that comes to us from various fields of scientific investigation, it seemed more logical, more reasonable to me to say that a human being is made of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is, but beyond that, there is a subtle mind element with very unusual powers that go beyond the current laws of physics as we understand them. There's a subtle mind element that has powers of extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, and all kinds of other things. And then beyond that, there is evidence for a conscious self that can exist completely apart from matter. So if you want to know what a human being is, a human being is a combination of matter, mind, and consciousness. And when I speak of mind and consciousness, I don't mean just temporary byproducts of bioelectrical activity in the brain. I mean different substances. Mind is a substance. Consciousness is a substance, just like gold or silver are. So then, once that's established, then when we think about this question of human origins, we have to think, well, where did this matter come from? Where did mind come from? Where did consciousness come from? And then how did they all come together in the human form? And that's what led me to this devolution concept, the idea that we don't evolve up from matter, but we start out as beings of pure consciousness and devolve from there, become covered by these lower elements of mind and matter.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll cover that in a lot more detail in the coming hours. We want to make sure that you know that you can call in toll-free anywhere in the U.S., 877-876-5227 if you tuned in a little bit late. Anywhere in Canada, toll free 888-810-8322, and anywhere else on planet or off planet, you'll have to pay for the call, but you can make your question pretty quick. It's 530-876-3222. Well, let me see if I can address those three things, see if we can drill down into them a little bit. Now, something that's always fascinated me is the human genome. And my brother works as the chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins. And besides being at the leading edge of genetic research, they reveal that there are extremely small differences between individual human beings. After writing your best-selling textbook, the author, there was a book called Biochemical Predestination. Pretty rare for a textbook to become a bestseller, but that one was. The author was faced with a question. Where did the first protein on Earth come from? And after wrestling with it for a while, he decided that it came from DNA. And he realized that DNA was an engineered molecule. Now, where do you think that DNA came from?
Well, I would agree with that concept, that it's an engineered molecule. So the current scientific idea is that all these things sort of came together spontaneously. But yeah, DNA is such a complex molecule. It's just made of billions of subunits. And the way that it reproduces is so extremely complex. Nobody has yet been able to figure out how this DNA reproductive system could have arisen from more simple components. Of course, a lot of biochemists have ideas that they're floating, but none of them have won widespread acceptance in the scientific world, because all of them break down when you really look at the details. So to me, that suggests that yes, they are engineered molecules, that there is some higher intelligence in the cosmos that's responsible for the order and complexity that we observe, both in the physical and the biological world. So I would find, that word, that concept that the author you spoke of mentioned, of it being engineered, as the perfect way to describe it.
Well, if that's the case, which I think you and I both agree, and I think most of his graduate students agree, then it's pretty logical to assume that this three-dimensional body, this collection of minerals and bones and water that we live in, is not unique to the Earth. That this molecule is probably used and adapted in all kinds of places in the cosmos.
Well, I think that's you're also very correct about that. And it's interesting. A few years ago, my books have been published, as I said, in a lot of different languages. So Polish is one of the languages. So I was in Poland, in the city where I was speaking at a university, in the city where Copernicus lived. So, of course, Copernicus, as many know, he was the astronomer who got science away from the geocentric picture of the solar system.
Right.
So I was giving a talk at this university, and I said, well, maybe it's time to get away from our geocentric picture of biology, the idea that intelligent life only exists on Earth. And I was really surprised, the audience sort of, burst out in applause and kind of gave me a standing ovation, because I think people sense that. And really, it's even a part of mainstream science to some extent. For many years, the United States government funded a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's now gone into private funding. And I think it's very interesting that NASA, the National Space Administration, it's got regulations that they can search for only simple forms of life on other planets. They can't look for anything with higher intelligence or human-like. I think that's pretty amazing.
That is really amazing.
but still, I there are many scientists now who do believe that the odds are that in all the different planets that, they're discovering, even astronomically, evidence for planets on other solar systems and other parts of the galaxy. And there are millions of them, so just even from a strictly materialistic, scientific point of view, they think it's very likely that life has formed on some of these planets, and then on some of them it's developed higher intelligence as well. And it's interesting, at the last meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, of which I'm a member, it's the largest international organization of archaeologists, there was actually a session on extraterrestrial archaeology.
Really?
Which is very amazing, because this is a mainstream scientific organization, and they were, as archaeologists, they were trying to decide, well, what are we going to do when we start going to other planets and we start finding things? Now, some of the things they're going to find are things that we've sent out there. You know, we've sent probes to different planets and different parts of the solar system, and there's a lot of space junk floating out there, and archaeologists are going to have to deal with that. You know, just as we have to deal with the remains of past civilizations on this planet. But it's very interesting. They were also discussing, well, what are we going to do if we find probes that have been sent from outside our solar system?
And actually, what was the answer that they came up with?
Well, actually, you know, the United Nations and other governments are already starting to make treaties about what to do with space objects that they find. So professional archaeologists are already discussing, you know, this topic, you know, what to do with these things. You know, so if they find them. So sometimes, you know, when we hear about, you know, extraterrestrials and things of that sort, UFOs and all that sort of stuff, some people automatically think, well, that's in a different dimension from science. But I think science is opening up. Even mainstream science is opening up quite a bit these days to some possibilities that a few decades ago they wouldn't have discussed seriously at all.
Well,
now,
it seems kind of appropriate that they're finally yielding to the demand of the public. And, well, speaking of the public, I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, this is Robin from Charlotte. Hi, Brooks.
Hello.
Hi, can you speak up, by the way, on the radio? You're a little soft. Michael sounds great, but you sound way too soft. So if you could speak up, that would be great.
We're using two cans and a string over here in East Tennessee, so it's probably the best I'm going to get all night.
Well, you're going to have to just raise your voice one or two notches, that's all. Anyway, I do have a question for Michael, actually a couple if I may.
Sure.
Michael, since you were bringing up the DNA question and genes, there's something you may be able to help me out with and clarify for me. It's kind of come to me that people actually, when they get in contact with each other and they're sympathetic with each other in the same kind of mood, or they have the same kind of frequency going, you know, that it occurred to me they transfer the genes or the DNA talks from one human being to another, almost like it transfers information, like it's communicating too. And I didn't know if anywhere in your studies you've come across that and thought that theory made sense. I mean, as far as like healers, you know, healers come and they'll heal someone, and someone believes that this person can heal them. And it's almost as if that that body, that person, because their body is healthier and their DNA is healthy, their genes, they're transferring information to the genes of the other individual, and they're changing it, you know, they're fine-tuning it. And so someone who was sick one day, the next is amazingly cured or healed. And it extends into other things too. But have you found anything in your studies or anything that would kind of indicate that may be the process that's going on when people, like when Jesus healed people or rose them from the dead and things like that, that it was because his DNA was actually communicating with the other DNA? He was transferring a communication.
Well, Robin, I think that may be part of the story, but I think there's more to it than that. Because as far as I can see, as human beings, DNA is part of what we are. You know, molecules are part of what we are. But beyond that, we have what I would call a subtle body, which cooperates with the DNA in giving us our particular form and personality. Because if you look at what happens with DNA, each of us starts out as a single cell, like a fertilized egg, which starts to split into 2, 4, 8, 16, and million, until finally you wind up with trillions of cells organized in the particular forms that we have. Like, you have trillions of cells, but they all started from a single cell. And the problem is that each cell has the exact same DNA. So then the question becomes, well, how does, as that cell division process goes on, how does a particular cell know that I'm going to be, a cell in the eye, or a blood cell, or a bone cell, or I'm going to be a cell that's producing hair on the top of the head. You know, there's so many different kinds of cells in the body. So they each have the exact same DNA in them. So I think there's something more than the DNA involved. I think there's a subtle body that serves as a template to guide the functioning of the DNA. And then the whole thing has to be energized. You know, just like, you may have a cell phone or something. It's a very complicated machine, but it won't work unless you put the battery in it to give it energy. So I think there's also a conscious self, which in Sanskrit is called an atma, that energizes the whole body with its DNA, with its subtle body. And the body is actually a very complex structure where you have the molecules, including the DNA that's there, but then you have this subtle body with subtle senses that is responsible for things like extrasensory perception and these feelings of communication with other bodies. And then you actually have the conscious self. And then we're not alone. We're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings. So in my book, Human Devolution, I have a whole chapter on what I call the paranormal modification and production of biological form, which involves studies of healing. You were mentioning healing. And from what I can see, it's a very intricate, complicated set of relationships that results in these healing kinds of experiences. A lot of the healers who have been very successful, such as John of God, in Brazil, and others, they say they normally don't attribute the healing ability just to themselves. They think they're operating on behalf of higher beings, who you could call gods, goddesses, astral beings, higher intelligences, angels. People have lots of different names for these higher entities. So it appears to be like a very complex set of relations that goes into these healing experiences. I think it involves the molecules, yes. It also involves the subtle body. It also involves the conscious self. It also involves interrelations with higher beings and the cosmos that result in these things. But
so
DNA would be part of it.
Are we saying that as the one of the triumvirate that sort of makes up the human body, you said we had the mind and we had the physical body and we had the consciousness or the matter, do we act upon matter with our mind in ways we can't explain with the laws of physics?
Well, yes. And, I mean, you're mentioning physics. There's what I would call a hidden history of physics. You know, I was once speaking at the Department of Nuclear Physics of the Science University in Budapest, Hungary, and my audience was about 100 physicists and graduate students of physics. And I started going through this hidden history of physics. You know, for example, every physics student learns about the work of Pierre and Marie Curie. Yeah, they were husband and wife.
Right.
They were both very prominent physicists. They both got Nobel Prizes for their work in discovering radium and doing a lot of the original research and radioactivity. So, everybody learns that in their textbook, but what you don't read in the textbooks is that they were heavily involved in psychical research. You know, they were part of a group of 20 prominent European scientists, including 5 Nobel Prize winners, who were doing this kind of research in Paris early in the 20th century. And this group of scientists did 2 years of research, among other things, with mediums. They were particularly studying an Italian medium named Eusebio Palladino. They did two years of research with this particular medium who had psychokinetic abilities, you know, mind over matter kinds of abilities. And these experiments didn't take place in somebody's dark living room, which is, you know, the usual skeptical sort of understanding of these things. These experiments took place at the Psychology Institute in Paris. And on numerous occasions, Marie Curie was there with other scientists controlling this medium, holding her hands, holding her legs, making sure she wasn't moving at all. While meanwhile, in the middle of the laboratory in broad daylight, you know, Pierre Curie, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, was noting a large table floating about 3 feet off the ground in the presence of this woman. And he was timing how long it was floating. He was measuring carefully how high it was floating off the ground. And numerous results like this were obtained in this series of experiments. And to me it indicates, well, yes, there is a subtle body that can act on ordinary matter in ways that we really can't explain by our current laws of physics. And there are many other areas of research into this particular type of phenomenon.
So if we picked up on Robin's question, we said, like she was saying, if two people or three people or a group of people come together and like I think we were using the other day the example of Jesus and Mary spending a lot of time anointing Jesus and touching Jesus and trying to help him and feel comfortable, that maybe with the mind, one person transfers energy in a form that's collected or responded to by the DNA of the other person.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good way of looking at it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking, Michael, because, I mean, I'm trying to account for family members who have actually healed themselves of diseases that you're not supposed to be cured of, or have, one member had a ruptured appendix for 11 days, and that person should have died, but they didn't, because that body actually coagulated and put a gel around it and protected it and kept the poisons from going, and actually it was healing itself. The person didn't know it had a ruptured appendix. I mean, it felt it, but it was diagnosed as something else, so he thought it was something else. But the point was, because that individual had no intent of suffering from, you know, something serious, the intent was, well, just get healthy, you know, I'll feel better, you know, I'm going to feel better. So the focus from that individual on his own DNA and on his own, with his own, or maybe it was his genetics, actually kept him alive and kept him from dying from that.
Yes, I think that's what's going on. I think it's not simply just on the molecular level. I think it's the involvement of a subtle body, which is helping structure, you know, the biomolecular forms. And we also see this kind of thing happening in what are called stigmatics. You know, that this happens in, you know, among Catholics, for example, that sometimes people who are meditating very much on the Passion of Christ, for example, will show the same kinds of wounds on their own physical forms, which to me suggests is that their mental state, the state of their subtle body, causes their physical body, you know, the DNA and the tissues and whatever, to take on forms that they wouldn't necessarily have taken on without the involvement of this mental energy, this subtle energy that's become involved in the process.
Okay, then I would ask you one more question. If that mental energy or subtle energy, is it in the form of a frequency? Is it a sound, or is it an emotional frequency, a tone?
I like the concept of a frequency or a vibration, because energies generally involve, you know, some kind of vibration. And in some of these healing practices, you know, that I'm familiar with from India, they involve mantras. So mantras are sound vibrations, and for them to be effective, they have to be vibrated, as you say, in a particular way. You could call it at a particular frequency. So I think this is this idea that, you know, the energies have to be tuned in a proper way for them to work in the intended way is something that I would agree with. And I would say in these past civilizations, people understood how to do these things, whereas today we've kind of lost that knowledge, and we're kind of simply depending on more grosser kinds of manipulations of matter.
Well, that brings up a very interesting question. Earlier, you're talking about Pierre and Marie Curie actually consulting with a medium to get an answer about radioactivity. Why do you think they were so convinced that the answers they sought could be found through a medium and not through a university or more scientific experiments? Is it that they were maybe trying to tap into the knowledge of past civilizations to help them understand something that they'd already won the Nobel Prize for?
Well, they were looking for, they weren't consulting this medium on the level that you would ask a person a question.
Right.
They just noticed that she had some very unusual powers. And Pierre Curie thought that these powers, by studying these powers that this medium had, it would help him understand investigations he was carrying out in electromagnetism and things like that. You know, he was interested in, you know, monopoles and you know, like magnetized particles that exist not in dipole form but monopole form. And so he was thinking that somehow or other, by carrying out these investigations, it would give him some clues to things that he was investigating in the normal scientific way, but getting stymied, not getting anywhere. So I think that's why, you know, he was particularly interested in this. And then also, I think just as scientists, they were interested in everything that's actually real about the world that we live in. And things like psychokinesis and telepathy are real things. Now, there are some scientists who are going to say, well, no, we're not going to talk about those things because the only things that we're prepared to say really exist in the world are things that we can explain by our current laws of physics. And so when they hear about these other kinds of phenomena, they think, well, that can't be true. So there's what I would call a process of knowledge filtration that goes on in the world of science. But that is really, I think, detrimental to the cause of science.
Oh,
and I
couldn't agree more, because you have almost religious canonization that has to go on in order to make the jump from paranormal to the realm of peer-reviewed. But you know, there are thousands upon thousands of very well-documented and controlled studies on human psychic abilities. Why, after all these decades of research, are they still called paranormal?
Yeah, I think it's part of what the normal is, really.
Yeah.
It's called paranormal. But that depends on having an open mind and being willing to just accept what is really happening out there and then adjust your ideas to account for it. And I think that's where the real scientific advancement comes in. And you were mentioning canonization. So in one sense, in terms of ordinary science, Pierre and Marie Curie are saints. Actually, Marie Curie, she came from Poland originally. Her name was Marie Skłodowska, you know, before she married Pierre Curie. So again, I was mentioning this tour I did of Poland a few years ago. So I was in Poland, and I was at a salon, which is kind of an event where, you know, they bring together some philosophers and scientists at some person's home, and you have somebody's an invited guest who talks, and then there's questions, and then they have some refreshments and things. So I was the invited guest at this salon, and I talked about Marie Curie and what she had done in investigating these mediums and doing this so-called paranormal research. And there was a physicist from the university there, and he stood up in the middle of my talk and said, "No, this cannot be true." It was like I had blasphemed his saint, Marie Curie, because he just knew the ordinary history, you know, that she'd gotten her Nobel Prize in physics for discovering radium.
Right.
He'd never heard, you know, that she had engaged in this kind of research, because it's filtered out. You know, like you say, when you have a saint, sometimes you kind of, you write their biography in such a way that, you know, you leave out certain things that might cause people to question them. So I think that's happened. There are scientific canonizations of certain personalities as saints of materialism, but if you look deeper into their actual scientific histories, you'll see sometimes they were investigating things that, according to conventional science, shouldn't be investigated.
Well, I have a question too, and I see that I think it stops you from looking and investigating. I think there's a lot of history out there where scientists could be, or engineers, or looking at certain things right now from the past, like the Egyptian hieroglyphs. If you see Isis and Osiris, it looked like she was using a form of technology when she was helping him to ascend. And there has been a Tesla-type technology, actually. And do you think that, I've heard that Tesla himself had experienced, when he was working with his technology, kind of OBEs, out-of-body experiences and things like that. It actually promoted a higher consciousness or extension. And when you start looking at that, like I said, the hieroglyphs in Egypt, you look at the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is kind of an instruction manual on how to, you know, ascend. If you look at the Cather's Book of Love, which was kind of an instruction manual on how to reach a higher consciousness or ascend, and I look at Science Now, who wants you to stop you dead in the tracks and say, well, these hieroglyphs are just myths and stories and stuff like that, do you see that where technologies that could be coming forth right now, I mean, we certainly have the brilliance out there, are unfortunately being suppressed or not being explored?
Yes, the basic picture that you've outlined there is what I'm also thinking. And like in Human Devolution, I have a chapter on cross-cultural study of cosmologies. You were mentioning, you know, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and what the Cathars believed, you know, that it's practically every culture that has ever existed down through the history of the earth has accepted that there's a non-material essence to what a human being is. They pretty much all have the idea that we have a gross physical body, we have a subtle body, and that there's a conscious self that can exist apart from all of them. Sort of like, you know, if you have, you look at it in terms of a computer analogy, you know, there's the computer hardware. Then there's the computer software, which, you know, the computer hardware you could compare to the gross physical body. And then you've got the computer software that lets a user interact with the hardware, And then finally, you've got the user himself or herself. So you could say the computer hardware is like the gross physical body. The computer software is like the subtle body of mind and intelligence. And then the computer user is like the conscious self who's making use of these subtle technologies to carry out purposes in this world. Of course, ultimately, I don't think we need those. According to the devolution concept that I'm talking about, we begin our existence as beings of pure consciousness on the highest level of the cosmos. And it's only when we enter into these lower levels of mind and matter that we need some kind of vehicle that's going to allow us to function here. Just like as human beings, we normally exist on the land. And if we want to go into a foreign element like water and function there, we need some kind of vehicle. We need like a boat or a submarine or a diving suit or something that will let us function in that alien element. So I think these gross and subtle bodies that we have are vehicles that allow us to function at these lower levels of the cosmos. I think all these wisdom traditions that you mentioned, the Egyptian, the Cathars, and others, they understood that really, you know, the purpose of human existence is to transfer the conscious self back to its original level of pure consciousness or spirit, if you like that word. Now, in terms of the technologies that you mentioned, that, you know, looking at the hieroglyphs, you see, you know, apparent signs of some kind of technologies involved. I would say, yes, these ancient civilizations did have technologies that are really pretty amazing. I mean, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India described that in ancient times there were civilizations that had spaceships, they were called vimanas, that allowed people to travel not just from place to place, from planet to planet, but from dimension to dimension in the cosmic hierarchy of beings. They also described that people had the ability to manipulate atoms. They could tell time by the movements of atoms. They were able to construct weapons, sort of like our modern nuclear weapons, in a sense. And they also had other kinds of technologies. And I think some of these technologies were based on more subtle principles than we are familiar with today. And in one sense, I think a lot of what we're doing with our modern technologies is we're trying to reproduce in our own cruder ways these technologies that the ancients had in a more perfect form. And even, I think the ancients had natural abilities of telepathy and things like that that we're trying to duplicate with technology. I think our cell phones, our internet, our television, radio, and things like that is our attempt to reproduce technologically these telepathic and extrasensory powers that people naturally had in some of these ancient cultures.
Well, I want to thank you. I got to go. I've got another call coming in. But what I would ask is if how is it that even now, I mean, especially since this has been out there and it does parallel so many technologies today, how is it that it's being ignored? Because when you see something that was written thousands of years ago that parallel a technology that we have today, doesn't it make sense that maybe it does have some credibility and it was based, in fact, in truth, and it's not necessarily a story or a myth? And I'm going to let you go. I'm going to go and let somebody else call in and listen for your answer. Thank you, Michael.
All right. We got to take a break. We'll get to that answer right after these messages. And we'll be back in about 6 minutes. If you want to take a break, Michael, you can. And we'll be back right after these messages with more of X Squared Radio.
know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase with a $5 discount. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to buy my inkjet cartridges at a national chain store that will remain unnamed for about $35 per cartridge. The color and black cartridges together ran around $80. Well, no more. I discovered a great place to buy printer supplies at 123 Inkjets. They not only provide excellent quality and fast shipping, every time I buy, I get a chance to win a free printer. Stop paying high prices. Visit 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio today and start saving money. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store at X Squared Radio and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. I think if you know someone who loves the space program, and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio.
You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We're sorry for the quiet volume. I'm coming to you from East Tennessee, and I'm probably half a mile from the road, so it's possible that the sound level isn't really getting out there to you. But we're doing the best we can, trying to come to you from good places on the earth. My guest tonight is Michael Cremo. We've been actually going just about everywhere in the last hour. We started with ancient archaeology, forbidden archaeology, and his book, De-Evolution. Michael's going to be at the San Francisco Bay Area UFO Conference on the 25th and 26th of August. I'll be there as well as other speakers. That is the place to be in the country if you are interested in the subject of UFOs, ancient archaeology, a higher consciousness. This is the granddaddy of them all on the West Coast. Easy to find. It's at the Doubletree Hotel in San Jose. So you're definitely going to get a great, great exposure to all the best speakers and best authors in the country if you go there. Now, a couple weeks before that, the 8th through the 12th of August, there is an ET conference in Weed, California, just north of Mount Shasta City. Besides being one of the most beautiful places on Earth, with a view of Mount Shasta, it is also a place well known for higher consciousness. And I happen to know from personal experience that the facilities there at Siskiyou College are just fantastic. It's a great auditorium, a fantastic setting, a very inexpensive place to go to a conference. So if you're in Northern California or in Oregon and you want to make your way to Weed, California, I would definitely not miss that one. David Icke is going to be there, as well as other speakers. So that would be a good event to make it to as well. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back.
I trust that you can hear me okay now.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, it's a little better. We're going through two separate phone lines at the studio, and they're amplifying mine separately. So I'll try to be as clear as I can without any feedback. We were talking about the mind of humans, and you had separated human beings into three kinds of existence, I guess. One was matter, the other is mind, and the third is consciousness. I was going to ask you, this mind of humans, the human mind, have you given much thought to the origins of that, of the human mind? Where does the human mind come from?
Well, I look at these things as different energies. There's the gross physical body that we have is made of the energies of ordinary matter. And beyond that, there is a subtle body made of mind and senses that is material, but it's of a more subtle kind of matter than the gross physical matter of the body. But this subtle body with its subtle senses, it explains some very unusual things. For example, there's the phenomenon of phantom limbs. It's a medical phenomenon that's very well studied, that sometimes people will lose a limb. It's very unfortunate. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, but sometimes people do lose an arm or a leg, but they feel as if they still have it, and it has sensation. They feel like maybe their finger has been pricked, and they feel pain in the exact location where their finger should be, although they've lost that particular limb. And I think the reason for that is that the subtle body still has the senses and the limbs, and that's what explains that particular phenomenon. But then beyond that, there is the energy of the conscious self. Like, you may have a very complicated computer with all kinds of hardware and software in it, and it performs wonderfully, but without the conscious user, you don't observe anything. So I think our body is a very complex set of machinery, where, like a computer, in the sense where you have the hardware, which can be compared to the gross physical body, then you have the software, which could be compared to the mind, the mental body, the subtle body. And then beyond that, there's the conscious self, which is aware of the whole set of machinery and uses it, you know, in its gross and subtle aspects for different forms. Now, where does all that come from? I believe it comes from higher intelligences in the universe. I think the forms that we have are reflections in matter of eternally existing forms that exist at some higher level of the cosmos. It's sort of a, you could say, a virtual reality system that's been prepared, you know, for, you know, the conscious self. You know, just like you may have a person who goes into a movie theater, and the person has an existence apart from the movie theater. But when you sit down in that dark room in that chair and you look at the lights flashing on the screen in front of you, you enter into a different reality. If the director has done his job properly, you identify with the flashing lights on the screen. You identify with some particular pattern, you know, the hero or the heroine of the film, and then you begin to experience things through that person's persona. You know, for example, if you're sitting in the theater and you're looking at the flashing lights on the screen, and the flashing lights that represent the heroes going down some dark street, who's being followed by someone, then you feel this sense of danger. Or if the flashing lights on the screen show him meeting with his beloved, then you feel happy. You feel as if you're meeting the beloved. If the director's done the proper job, then you identify with all of that. But really, you have an existence completely apart from that virtual reality that's been created for you in the movie theater. Of course, there are even more realistic kinds of virtual reality systems that we could talk about. So I think the subtle and gross bodies that we have and the experiences that we undergo are part of a virtual reality system that's been prepared for us, because we've left our real set of spiritual experiences. We've entered into another dimension of reality from which, according to every wisdom of the wisdom tradition of the world, we need to wake ourselves up somehow. And that's the real purpose of all the different systems of contemplation, yoga, meditation that are there. in these different wisdom traditions, that meant to wake us up to our real existence apart from the virtual reality system that's been created for us by our mind, by our body.
Well, I see, I can understand the creation process, and I kind of feel like, oh, maybe it is an illusion, maybe it isn't an illusion, but it certainly hurts like it's real. When I think about the gross reality, the mountains that are there each time I come back, even though I'm not thinking about them, I realize that perhaps matter is the result of a joint agreement between all of the minds, all of the spirits that are in the universe, and that perhaps this isn't unreal at all, but perhaps very real and very important, and that the idea is not to escape as soon as possible, but to get here and to experience this universe through the limited senses of a physical body, because this experience, this sensation, this involvement one with another is the goal of the mind.
I agree with you in this sense, that yes, it's real, just like the virtual reality system that's set up for us in a theater or some other virtual reality system on the web. You know, for example, these joint computer games and things like that. I think, yes, it's real. It's not an illusion in that sense. There's something real there that's responsible for what we're undergoing. And I would agree with you, yes, it's not just an individual thing, it's a collective thing that we're all involved in and that we all contribute to in one way or another. And I would also agree with you that it's not necessarily that getting out is the main thing. There are things that we are meant to learn and experience here.
And if you don't, then...
What I would say is you remain entangled in this, I'm not going to call it an illusion, but I'm going to call it an alternative reality or a lower reality or something. Because on this level of reality where we are confined, you know, to the kinds of physical forms that we have, they're subjected to different kinds of processes. Technically in Sanskrit it's called samsara. It means like the wheel of birth and death, you know, that's there. Now, that is a reality. It's not unreal. It's not an illusion. But it is not the highest type of experience that it's possible for a conscious self to have. Neither are the kinds of relationships we have here necessarily the highest kinds of relationships that it's possible to have.
Well, there are high ones and there are low ones, and there are high lives and low lives. I admit that. And you mentioned a wheel of birth and death. Does the wheel just go around one time, or does it go around and around and around?
Well, wheel goes around many times. There's reincarnation. But what I would say is that, yes, we may have been here in many, many millions of incarnations, experiencing different realities, sometimes coming back with the same personalities that we've met in previous existences to keep going on with the dramas of our lives, to carry on with things that we've started and haven't finished.
Yeah.
But it's like, say, like a movie actor, like a you know, Robert De Niro or somebody like that. He's been in so many different kinds of films, and each one is playing a different character, a different situation. But as a person, yeah, you know, the actor, the actress has an existence apart from all of the different roles that they may be playing in these different films. There's a life outside that. So that's at the heart of the worldview that, you know, I've kind of come to see as the most logical one, that yes, there's, now when the actor is acting, yes, it's real. There are other people there. There's a director. There are cameras. It's real. It's not an illusion. But outside that, the actor has a different life.
Right. Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's not nearly as good as the one that he's having on the screen.
That can't be true, right?
Let's talk about the work of Robert John. How was he able to measure the effects of the human mind on matter? Not just the matter of the human body, but the matter of the universe.
Well, I like his research a lot because it supports the idea that there is a subtle mental body that can operate on ordinary matter in ways that we really find difficult to explain in terms of the normal laws of physics. Of course, Robert John was the head of the engineering department at Princeton University. And some years ago, he and some of his colleagues started doing experiments with random number generators. These random number generators are computer-like machines that will generate as an output a genuinely random series of usually zeros and ones. The machines are set up not like a pseudo-random number generator, which we can find in many computers, but it's actually based on setting up an electrical current which is broken randomly by quantum processes on the atomic level. So it's a genuinely random series of events that gets recorded in these random number generators. And if you let the machines run by themselves, they would generate 50% zeros, 50% ones. They would generate a baseline like that, which is what you would expect if you've got two things, two possibilities, and that they're being randomly selected. You let that process go on, and you'll generate 50% ones, 50% zeros. However, what John and his colleagues found was that if they put student volunteers from the university in front of these random number generators, and instructed them to, for example, will mentally that the machines generate more ones than zeros, he found they were actually able to do it to a statistically significant degree, a small but statistically significant degree that you would not expect if things were just going on according to normal statistics and normal laws of physics.
Now, was that user-dependent, like one person could do it better than another person?
He found that the ability was widely distributed.
Wow.
But that some people were able to do it to a greater degree than others. That was found. It's like many abilities, for example, musical abilities, they're distributed widely throughout the population. Everyone has some musical ability, but some people have more than others. So that same type of distribution was observed in these studies with these random number generators, which were carried out through what he called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Group, PEAR for short, P-E-A-R. And you can search on the web and find the whole data set. Just recently, they closed the project, after it had been operating for about 20 years. And he said, we've accumulated all this data, and now it's time to wind up this project. But I found it to be a very interesting project where you get hard information, data, that suggests there is a mind element that can operate on physical processes in ways that you really can't explain.
And it's repeatable.
According to the current view of things.
And it's repeatable. If you put that person in the chair, they're able to influence it again and again.
Right. Yes.
Wow.
So that's what I found very interesting about.
Now was the effect only real time, or did the study reach beyond the present time, like into the past or into the future?
Well, yes, it did. He found actually they were able to retrodict things. you know, that sometimes they would record the results of the random number generator and then ask people to mentally will, for example, that, you know, more ones than zeros would produce, and they would find they were able to do that, even though the results had been recorded before the mental intention, which to John and his colleagues suggested some kind of ability to reverse the normal time sequence of causality, because normally we think that causation works only in one direction, that you've got a flow of causality going from past to present, that the arrow of time goes only in one direction. Whereas these results that he was getting, you know, when he set up the experiment that way, would suggest some kind of reverse causality, which I think is very amazing.
Yeah, that is extremely amazing, because when the random number generator runs with a reasonably large population, like, I don't know, say a million numbers, which you would expect it to be normally distributed 50-50.
Right.
That's all done in the can, recorded, and on digital tape. Now, it appears from this data that the observer, the one who's actually going to affect the count, has to go back in time in his mind to when the numbers were collected and imagine the number generator running and then influence the numbers in the past, which then changes the result in the recording.
Yeah, that's apparently that's the sort of thing that would have to happen. Now, just add that in physics and in philosophy of science, it is an unsolved mystery why we observe this arrow of time, because most physical laws, practically all physical laws, are time reversible. They work in both directions.
For example,
like if an ice cube is melting according to the laws of physics, there could be a situation where you would see the ice cube reconstitute itself, even in a warm room, because the laws of physics allow for that possibility. You know, that, yeah, you could have, you know, like a glass of ice water with some ice cubes in it. Normally you see the ice cubes melting. But according to the laws of physics, it could just as well happen that you could have a glass of water, you know, with some half-melted ice cubes in it, and they would reconstitute themselves. Statistically, that's probable, and it should be happening, you know, if the laws of physics really are time reversible as they are in the form that we have them. So it's actually a great mystery why the arrow of time just goes in one direction.
I think the reason is it's
been set up that way by intelligence. That's what I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that may explain why Windows doesn't come with failure as an option. It's built in. It just it works. Tell us about, now, since we're talking about going back in the past and changing random number generators, and maybe some things even more complicated than that, maybe we can go back and reobserve something that happened in our own past and change it, which then changes the present for us. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Michael Saborn's work. He did work in out-of-body experiences, and now this really gets fascinating.
Well, yes, this has to do with the idea that there's a conscious self that can exist apart from matter. The work of Robert John, I believe, shows that there's a subtle mind element that can influence matter, that the mind of these subjects could influence the random number generators, which are made of ordinary matter.
Right.
So, but I also believe beyond that, beyond this scientific evidence for a subtle mind element, that there's scientific evidence for a conscious self that can exist apart from the body, completely apart from the mind, And I think that comes from these studies of out-of-body experiences, such as the ones that Michael Sabum carried out. And he was a cardiologist, and he began hearing from some of his patients, his heart attack patients, reports of out-of-body experiences. And he became fascinated by this topic, but then he began to think, well, are these accounts really true, or are they just making it up? So he began to think, well, is there any way that I could sort of test whether these accounts are real or just made up? And what he decided to do was this. You know, he took a group of about 25 of his heart attack patients who had reported these out-of-body experiences. So he carefully recorded from them each detail that they could recall about what they had observed, because typically they would report observing what the doctors and nurses trying to revive them were doing, what they were saying, what they were doing, what kinds of equipment they were using, and things like that. So what he did is he interviewed each person very carefully, got them to recall every possible detail of what they had observed. Then what he did is he compared those reports to the records kept by the physicians and the nurses who had treated them.
Uh-huh.
And the patients don't see these detailed medical records. And he found that what they said corresponded to the detailed medical records kept by the physicians and nurses who had treated them. And in each case, it's different. It's not that exactly the same procedure is used in each heart attack resuscitation. So then he thought, well, why is that? You know, maybe they've just seen a lot of doctor movies or TV programs. Maybe they talked to other patients in the hospital. So to kind of test against that they just sort of, based on information that they had, were able to come up with a report that matched their medical records, he took another group of heart attack patients who had not reported these out-of-body experiences, and he asked them, just on the basis of any doctor shows that you've seen, on the basis of any conversations you've had with doctors and patients in the hospital, just try to imagine for me what you think happened when you were unconscious during your heart attack.
Excellent.
When the doctors and nurses were trying to revive you. So he carefully collected their stories. He compared them to their medical records. He found they all made major mistakes. None of them got it right. So he took that as
That's
an indication
profound.
That what the first group had said was true.
Huh.
And I take that as evidence for a conscious self that can separate temporarily from the body and then re-enter the same body.
Well, I'm wondering, this out-of-body experience, this consciousness that is separate, although living or cohabitating inside this physical body, which I guess can get along perfectly well without the conscious body being in it, maybe just a thread of it, but it appears the conscious body can see things even though the physical body is sound asleep and being breathed for and having its heart worked on. So what about visiting other times out of body?
I think that's possible. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak of some cases of time travel. For example, there was there's an interesting history about a king named Kukudmi who lived in very, very ancient times. And he had a daughter named Revati, and he was considering who she should marry, and he was considering different princes and kings who lived at this time. So to get an answer, he decided to go with his daughter to a higher planet in the universe, at a different dimension of reality, the planet of Brahma. So according to these ancient Sanskrit histories, he went to the planet of Brahma, and he wanted to talk to Brahma, who was a demigod responsible for the affairs going on in the universe. And he was told, well, you have to wait a minute, because he's at a concert now, but as soon as the concert's over, he'll come and talk to you. So after a minute, Brahma came and he began to explain what he wanted to talk about. Well, my daughter, I'm looking for a nice husband for her. I'm thinking of this king or that king. And Brahma started to laugh. He said, in the time you've been here, millions of years have gone by on Earth. And everybody you're talking about is long gone. But he said, all right, but when you go back, you'll find somebody that'll be perfect for her. So when he went back down to Earth, millions of years had passed. It's kind of the case of time travel. I think it's possible to travel to the future. I'm not entirely sure whether it's possible to travel into the past, although I think it's possible to get knowledge of what happened in the past. There's a mystic power that in Sanskrit is called Trikalagya, which means there are persons who can know perfectly everything that has happened in the past, everything that's happening at present, and everything that's going to happen in the future. So,
sounds kind of boring. How would you go through life with any kind of mystery if you knew everything?
Yeah, that's. I'm certainly not in that position. I'm surprised every day.
I'd just like to know a couple things. Maybe the New York Stock Exchange report 30 days from now would be nice.
And, of course, I'm not entirely sure that when you know that, because I think the future is constantly changing based
sure.
on the decisions that we make now.
Yeah, it's always in motion.
Yeah, always in motion.
Well, do you think that the observation effect that we see in instrumental analysis, my background is in physics, and my specific background is in instrumental analysis, and one of the things that we curse on a regular basis is the effect we're having on the sample by the measurement we're trying to take. It's like you can't get in there and look without affecting it. So do you think the observation effect by the person who is out of body has an influence on the universe?
Well, yes, I think our consciousness does influence the states of matter around us. It affects our own being. It affects others. Yes, I think the answer to that, yes, I do believe our states of consciousness do have an influence on the world around us. As a matter of fact, the kind of body that we have now is based on our state of consciousness in our previous lifetime, I would say. That the kind of body that I have now is a result of my state of consciousness at the end of my last existence. And that what I'm doing now in this life, as I'm preparing my consciousness in a certain way, that's going to determine what my next reality is going to be. So I think we have to be careful about our state of consciousness because it affects a lot. It affects a lot.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, do you feel that we are asleep or that we're awake while in this body on this earth?
In one sense, you could say it's both. Say if you're asleep and dreaming,
okay.
There's a certain reality. You're awake in your dream, but physically, somebody who is looking at you would say you're asleep. But you're in terms of your own subjective experience, you're awake, you're experiencing things. They have a certain reality to them. But I would say there's what you might call different levels of waking. In your dream, you're conscious, you're aware of what's going on. You could say you're awake in a sense, but really you're not. So I would say there are higher levels of awareness that it's possible to attain. And that's the contribution that the great wisdom traditions of the world have always been offering. Systems of contemplation, meditation, yoga that raise levels of consciousness so that you get a more perfect or higher level of awareness or waking, you could say.
Well, I have found through my own personal experience and through speaking with others who have had higher experiences, such as you're speaking about, that they have a tendency a need to conquer their fears. That fear is more or less a dark energy, and I guess you could call the opposite of that love. I'm kind of reminded of the words of, well, let's say Jesus, who said the highest commandment is to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and spirit, and then the second is like unto it, to love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, if you kind of take that commandment in Greek fashion and work it in reverse, then what Jesus is really telling us to do is to love ourselves. And as we express and experience and perfect that love for ourselves, we also raise our ability to love others. And thus, we have no fear in anything that we do. So this awareness that you're talking about is a function of that conquering of fear in ourselves.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. You know, the particular type of meditation and yoga system that I practice is, you know, it comes from India. It's called bhakti yoga. So bhakti means the yoga of love and devotion, because you know, as you were saying, originally we're meant to love God, love each being, love ourselves as spiritual parts of the same spiritual whole, really.
Yeah.
So that is something I very much believe in. Yes, it's actually what I've dedicated my life to, is overcoming that fear. There's a Sanskrit word for fear. It's called bhayam. And it says that fear comes when we separate ourselves from the spiritual whole. Then we become very fearful of everything. But by reconnecting with our real self, with the real selves of others, with the real supreme self that is God, then these kinds of loving feelings towards all living things, towards the source of all living things, towards ourselves, begins to manifest. And otherwise, we do exist in the realm of fear, which means we try to protect ourselves, we try to protect our families, our nations, and you get involved in all kinds of complexities based on competition. And it produces a very, very, very unfortunate situation where the result becomes all this kind of environmental destruction and senseless violence that we see around us. So ultimately, that's what, you know, my work is all about. You know, my forbidden archaeology work, my work in this human devolution topic that I'm talking about, is ultimately to change the heart, to allow it to express what you're talking about. That love for ourselves, love for the source of all conscious beings, love for every other conscious being, ultimately, that's what it's all about. Yes, I agree with you on that.
That sounds like very powerful science. So let me ask you a question. We have this matter body, and we've got the mind, this personality, this id, this thing that makes up Michael, that makes up Brooks, that makes up all of our colors. Why do you think the consciousness chooses to stay with a body? I mean, if it's so good out there in painless space, why descend into a mortal body in the first place, or the second place, or the millionth place, let alone stay here?
Well, that has to do with this question of love. Because ultimately, we're meant to exist on the platform of pure spiritual love, eternally, with all other conscious beings, with the source of all conscious beings, which we could call God. But love cannot be forced. Love has to be given freely, which means that as beings of pure consciousness, we have the choice whether to love or not love. And the opposite of love is selfishness. Not the kind of positive self-appreciation, but the negative kind of selfishness that puts oneself above every other self and tries to organize everything in terms of one's own selfish desires. So that freedom has to be something that we can actually exercise. So that's part of what love is, the freedom to not love. So if we exercise that freedom to not love, that means we have to be somewhere else. Because on that higher spiritual dimension of reality, the only thing that's going on is pure love. So if we put ourselves in the position of not loving, we need a place to exist. In our original spiritual body, it's only meant for loving God, loving all other living things. So if we put ourselves in the position of not loving, that means we need another place and another form. So we're given this other form. And as long as we want to keep ourselves in that position of not loving, of being selfish, then we remain on the material level of existence in a material form. Now, the one thing that I would like to add is that if we use our vehicle for the purpose of pure love, it becomes spiritual. Even this world can become spiritual. Our material body can become spiritual if we use it for a spiritual purpose. So it's not necessarily that we have to wait until we get out of this world, out of this body, to attain the platform of spiritual love.
I was going to ask a question.
Sure, go ahead.
So it is possible that between your consciousness and your mind, or your mind that is awake as consciousness, or the two in combination, can actually change the matter of the body to this loving being, this higher vibrational being, and thus maybe you become separated from the fearful and hateful or selfish world.
Yes. Absolutely. Just like, say if you have an iron bar. Iron is not fire. But say if you put the iron bar in the fire and leave it there, it'll become red hot. And then you could take that iron bar and touch a piece of paper, and the paper will burst into flame. So similarly, like, we have a vehicle, a body made of matter. But if we keep it in the fire of a spiritual purpose, then even though it's matter, it becomes able to act just like spirit would. And actually, the only real difference between matter and spirit is our forgetfulness of the connection of matter with its spiritual source, God, basically. If you're on a level where you can see everything, all energies, and their proper relationship with the source of all these energies, God, then everything becomes spiritual, even this world. It's all a matter of how you see it and how you use it. So yes, I would agree with you. Yes, it's possible to transform the energies of the body, of the mind, of the world around us in such a way that they become higher.
Wow. Now, does raw consciousness, does it have a shape, or are we like these energy orbs we see pictures of from time to time? Is it that kind of energy existence?
If you're asking what my personal understanding is.
Yeah.
My understanding is that the original form of consciousness is personal. There is a personal form. And actually, our physical forms that we have are kind of molded on that original form of consciousness. In other words, like, say if I put on a glove, you know, the glove has five fingers on it. So why does the glove have five fingers? It's because the form of, you know, the body has five fingers, therefore the covering has five fingers. So I would say the reason why our physical bodies have form is because the form of the conscious self also has form that our physical body shapes itself around.
So
I would say, no, we're not just a glowing orb, that as conscious spiritual beings, we have spiritual senses, spiritual form, and now that's just covered. It's sort of covered over, but why does the material covering have the particular form that it does? It's because what's underneath the form of consciousness is there.
Exactly. Very good. Very good. Well, I could tell you a story about a friend of mine who, well, he married a woman who already had a son, and so he adopted the son, and the son was about 3 or maybe 4 years old, a pretty good talker for his age. And the little boy's kind of getting out of the bathtub, out of the bubble bath, and they're having a good old time. You know how you can be with a four-year-old, just you become four yourself, and you don't realize that that kids can come across with something extremely intelligent right out of the middle of this playtime. The boy stops, looking dead in the face, and says, "Do you remember when I was your daddy and I rode you on the red tractor?" And it just about floored him, because that's exactly what his father used to do when he was a little boy of 5 or 6 years old. But his father had passed away about 6 years before that. Now, that, you know, this is something where this boy was not in his bloodline. He had just met this woman a couple of years before and married her and, you know, basically became the son's stepfather, but really the only father that the boy knew. And here in the middle of frivolity, he just stops dead serious and says something like that. Now, that's pretty powerful, and it really affected him.
Yeah, I think those kinds of things happening. I was, you know, mentioning in response to something you said earlier on the show that sometimes we come back into, you know, into cycles of reincarnation. We come back in touch with people that we have known or been related to in past lives. I think this, you know, this particular example, you know, that, you know, you're talking about is something that really bears that out.
Well, yeah, but it opens some unique questions. You know, first, how did my friend's father know that his son was going to be the new stepfather of this little boy? I mean, they weren't related. It's not like he came back as his blood son. He came back in this other boy who, in the future, far in the future, would be adopted by my friend. So how did the father know in time? I mean, that's...
Well, he may not have known. I think some of these things are arrangements that are made by higher powers as well.
Oh,
it may
sure.
not have been just between. Yeah, it may not have been just his decision.
He could have said, you know, there's a really good chance that that he is going to marry this woman and you're going to be born to this woman, and that's how you're going to hook up again. So do you think soulmates or conscious friends follow each other around the universe to share mortal lives together?
I think that does happen. And sometimes, you know, they signal, you know, what's going to happen. You know, in the research that we were mentioning earlier that was carried out by Ian Stevenson, you know, who's investigated a lot of cases of past life memories. Yeah, he came up with some very interesting cases. Like there was a case of a Tlingit Indian gentleman from Alaska, you know, whose name was William George, and he told his son, and he had a son, Reginald, and his son was married. So he told them, he was getting pretty old. So he told them, if there's anything to this reincarnation business, I'm going to come back, and I'll be your son, and you'll recognize me because on he described, he had moles on a certain part of his body, his left shoulder and on his left forearm, and then he gave his son his gold watch and said, okay, I want you to keep this for me, and in my next life, I'm going to find that watch. So Reginald gave the watch to his wife, told her what his father had said, so she put the watch in a jewelry box. Now, this William George, he was a fisherman. So he was, a few weeks later, he was lost at sea. You know, he was out on a fishing boat, and as often happens up there in Alaska, it's a very dangerous profession, fishing. I think more people die in those fishing boats than in any other kind of work. So he was lost at sea. So afterwards, the wife of his son became pregnant, and sometimes this happens. People have dream experiences. Like when she was in labor, she saw her father-in-law in a dream, and he, when the child was born, she named him William George Jr. After his father-in-law. And he had the same moles in the same place as his grandfather did, his dead grandfather. And then once, he when he was about 5 years old, when this child was about 5 years old, his mother saw him go into the jewelry box, pick up the watch, and say, "That's my watch." So you've got cases like that that have been documented by researchers who have specialized at this topic of reincarnation, where apparently you do have souls coming back to continue relationships with people that they knew during their existence. It's really a very interesting phenomenon.
Well, I think I've also heard recently of the phenomenon that's been going on for about 50 years, or maybe a little longer, called star children. These souls that have never been to this world, but they have lived on other worlds, and now they're coming here to experience a mortal life.
Well, I think that does happen. I think this process of reincarnation is going on all over the cosmos, not just on our planet.
Sure.
One of the fundamental things that I try to get across in my book, Human Devolution, is that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, and there are relationships between souls on our level of reality and from other planets, other dimensions. We're not alone in the cosmos, and there are relationships that go on, that the process of reincarnation may take us not just from body to body on this planet, but into other bodies on other planets, at other dimensions of the cosmos. So it doesn't surprise me at all that there are souls now taking birth on our planet that have come from other dimensions, from other levels of reality, other planets. It doesn't surprise me at all that that would happen, and that their memories, if they are accessed, would show that, definitely.
Well, I like where this is going. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in about 6 minutes with our final hour with Michael Cremo. So don't go away. And remember, the phone lines are open. We'll give the numbers out again right after these messages. And this is X Squared Radio with Brooks Agnew and Michael Cremo. Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. Shalimar Productions was created from a vision to bring to Mount Shasta the masters who are out there on the front lines helping to awaken a sleeping humanity. From July 12th through August 12th, you can watch this dream unfold through three great conferences, including workshops. Nikhil Ledwick, William Henry, Sherry Soria, David Carmos, as well as David Icke and others will offer you their wisdom and experience. This is just a sample of the life-changing knowledge you can gain by clicking on the Shalimar Productions banner at X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Think it's possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio.
you own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchased all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 1D3 Inkjet. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjet at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Overnightprints.com. If you use business cards on paper, we're talking full color process with UV coating, even UV spot coating, postcards, brochures, letterhead, envelopes, even greeting cards. Order by 5 p.m. Pacific time and get it the next morning anywhere in the country. No other printer like it in the U.S. Overnightprints.com. Just go to the website at x2-radio.com, X Squared Radio. Click on the Overnight Prints banner and use the code word X Squared. When you do, you'll get 10% off, and always you get free shipping. I also wanted to give you some update on the Inner Earth Expedition. We are assembling our team. We added one more explorer with us to our science team 2 weeks ago, and we're looking to add a few more. So if you want to apply, go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org and follow the links to Advanced Planetary Explorations. Fill out the questionnaire. It's free. Send it to us, and we'll put you in the database. A lot of people ask us, how much does it cost to get on that Russian nuclear-powered icebreaker? The answer is nothing. If we charge people, we have found that we don't get the kind of profile that we're looking for scientists and serious people. We get people who are maybe just wanting to go to the North Pole with us. We are actually trying to assemble a science team of 100 people, various disciplines. We're also bringing musicians, photographers, and as well as some grad students to take some measurements for us. We'll be measuring the pH of the water, the salinity of the water. We'll be taking core samples off the ocean floor when we can get through the ice. We'll be taking ice samples, underwater photography of marine life. So there is a lot of good science that's going to be done, in addition to magnetism measurements and aurora borealis measurements and photography, and some more paranormal things going on as well. So check out phoenixsciencefoundation.org. See if that's an expedition you're interested in. and we'll keep you up to date right here. Also, don't forget about the ET conference in Weed, California. Go to ShalimarProductions.com or just click on the link at X Squared Radio and sign up for that one. And for sure, don't pass up the San Francisco Bay Area UFO Conference, the 25th and 26th of August. You can check it out by going to the Bay Area UFO Expo.com, kind of a long name, or just Google it. You'll find it. I promise you it'll be worth it. We're going to have great speakers there like Michael Cremo, who is my guest right now. And we were having a great discussion about reincarnation, consciousness, and even the fact that the conscious body does prefer to reside with the physical body. In fact, it even shapes the physical body. And that maybe right here on Earth, right here in physical form, you can reach a higher state of awareness. And I think that's kind of where we left off. You know, Michael, what I can tell people who insist, what is it that I can say to people who can't get it out of their minds that we get one shot at mortality, and if we pray to the wrong God or go to the wrong church, we're going to hell? What do I tell people like that?
Well, I mean, sometimes you can't tell them anything, but what I would say is that if you believe that God is all merciful, because mostly they believe in a God, and God should have every quality, such as mercy, and if God is all merciful, then why would an all-merciful God not give you as many chances as it requires for you to make up your mind to go back to him? So that's what I would say. Now, whether they accept it or not, that's another question. But I think for people who can accept this idea that if there is a God, God must be all-merciful, then why would an all-merciful God only give you one chance? And I don't think anyone is eternally put into a bad situation by anything other than their own choice, by their own unwillingness to take the steps necessary to go back to that original position of pure love. That's the only thing. God would never deny anyone the right to make progress towards returning to that position of pure love. That's what I would say.
I agree with that. Now, it doesn't, well, but it doesn't take much of an observer to realize that there are different levels of development for various beings. I mean, there are human beings that I would say are very highly developed, very aware, very merciful, very open-minded and explorer types. And then there are others who are just warriors. They just, they're hunter-gatherers. They can't think beyond the next meal. So what do you think about there being different levels of development for different beings?
Yes, I think we all have choices to make. And the choices we make are going to determine what our experience is like individually and collectively. So I think down through history, we've always seen that there are some souls who are trying to appreciate the spirituality of all other living things, who are trying to make progress spiritually. I'm not saying we have to go back to the Stone Ages, but sort of, yeah, it's a question of balance. You know, like, say, food, for example. We know if you eat too much of the wrong kinds of things, it's going to be bad for your health. So similarly, I think if we consume too much of the wrong kinds of material products, it's not going to be good, you know, for our existence individually or collectively. And we're going to find individually that we're not really satisfied because we're starving ourselves spiritually. We do have spiritual needs that need to be satisfied. If we don't do that, we're going to suffer from it. And I think if we go too far in the direction of materialism, then we're going to be involved in all kinds of conflict, you know, for control of material resources. We're going to overexploit the material resources that are there, cause environmental destruction and things like that. So I think it's a question of balancing, you know, the material and spiritual aspects of human existence. And so we always see that there are these two basic paths that it's possible to take. So individually, we just have to decide which way we're going to go.
Well, what about in the universe? Are there different levels of beings in the universe? You mentioned earlier a hierarchy of some kind.
Yes. I think we are part of a cosmic hierarchy of beings, and practically every tradition that's ever existed, every knowledge tradition that's ever existed in the world has made this a part of their cosmology. But some people, I mean, they might say, well, it's very interesting, all these ancient wisdom traditions speak about us being part of a cosmic hierarchy of beings, but they're going to wonder, well, what sort of evidence there is that we can see today that would lead us to suspect, yes, there are conscious beings at other levels of this cosmic hierarchy. And I would say there's quite a bit of evidence, and it comes in, I'll just mention a few categories. One would be communications from spirits of departed humans, you know, who have gone to some other level of the cosmos, but who communicate somehow or other with beings on this level. And, you know, there are interesting cases of that. You know, for example, there was, you know, very famous English physicist, you know, early in the 20th century, Sir Oliver Lodge, who was a very prominent physicist. He had a son named Raymond who was killed during World War I. And then later, Oliver Lodge and his wife tried to contact him through, you know, a medium. And it was a very interesting experience because he was a professional scientist, so he was very much aware of all the different kinds of tricks, you know, that a medium could use to try to get information about a person and their departed relatives and then sort of deceive them in some way. So what he chose to do was disguise himself and approach a medium who didn't know him, who'd come from another country. This medium, he was an Englishman, and the medium had come from the United States. And it was in England. So he just said, okay, this person has no knowledge of me whatsoever. I'm going to go to her, you know, not announcing who I really am, in disguise, and see if she can establish, you know, some communication with this person. And it was amazing because the communication was actually established, and the spirit of his son Raymond began communicating all kinds of things that would have been known only within the intimate circle of the family. You know, it was really pretty amazing, and he wrote a whole book about it, which I find, you know, pretty interesting because it's by a professional scientist who kind of carefully dealt with all the usual kinds of skeptical objections to these sorts of communications. But I think another type of evidence that we get that we exist in the cosmic hierarchy of beings comes from cases of possession of spirits of humans on our level of existence by spirits of humans that have departed. And one interesting case I found in my research was a case reported by William James, who was the founder of modern psychology. And he reported this case in his textbook, Principles of Psychology, as what he regarded as a genuine case of spirit possession. He called it the Watseka Wonder. It's kind of interesting because I live on a street that's called Watseka Avenue. But there was, Watseka is a little town in the state of Illinois where in the late 19th century a family was living, the Venom family. They had a daughter named Lorancy Venom. And she lived a quite ordinary life until, when she was about 12, 13 years old, she started going into trance states. And in these trance states, she was found herself in communication with spirits of departed humans. And she met this girl, spirit of a girl, named Mary Roth. And this spirit said, I want to visit my family on Earth, and I'd like to make use of your body to do that. So when this happened, Marantz then found she didn't feel at home in her own house. She didn't recognize her own family members anymore. And she was speaking about this girl. And so her family decided, let us find this family. So they found the family, the Roth family, and they brought them to the house. And as they were coming up to the house, Lorenzi looked out. She saw, she recognized them. This is my mother. That's my sister. So both families agreed she should go and live with the Roth family. And she did that for several months. And she just perfectly behaved as their daughter. She manifested all kinds of knowledge of the family and its intimate affairs that would have only been known to the girl, Mary Roth. And this went on for some time until she again began going into trance states. And then the spirit of Mary Roth said, okay, now I'm going to go back to where I came from. And then after that happened, Lorenzi Venom no longer felt at home in the Roth family's house. She didn't recognize them anymore. She felt homesick. She wanted to go back to her mother and father and her sister. So both families agreed she should go back. Now, what I find interesting about that case, it was carefully studied by William James, the founder of modern psychology, and reported as a genuine case of spirit possession in his textbook, Principles of Psychology. And then I think another category of evidence that we exist in a cosmic hierarchy of beings comes from apparitions of spirits of departed humans, ghosts, and other birds.
Uh-huh.
That's very common, but there are scientists who have reported these experiences as well.
Well, now the question I have about the possession is, was that a voluntary possession? In other words, the possession didn't take place by force, right?
It appears that it was a cooperative endeavor
between
these two girls. It appears she agreed to it. Now, there are cases. People have seen that film, read the novel The Exorcist, but many people don't realize that's based on an actual case of an exorcism that was performed by a Catholic priest on a boy who lived in Washington, D.C. So it's an actual case.
Well, that's pretty scary.
And that possession by some kind of superhuman demoniac being wasn't a voluntary kind of thing at all.
Right. Well, I guess that's what I was trying to get at earlier, these different levels of beings. Are there beings that are so powerful out there that if they find the least bit of a crack in a person, that they can overcome them, or that they can make their way to a physical existence through someone else? Now, one sort of symbiotic relationship I can think of that is like possession is the relationship between Ramtha and Jay-Z Knight.
I know Jay-Z Knight. I've been up. She invited me up to her place some years ago, and I saw Ramtha there. And it was very interesting. Apparently, he likes my work.
Well, that's good.
Well,
apparently an example of a being that lived on the Earth 35,000 years ago and has an agreement with Jay-Z Knight that he can come here and teach using her body. And she just mentally or spiritually checks out while he's there.
Yes, but this sort of thing, it also happens in the case of healers. I was mentioning this John of God from Brazil. I mean, the way he explains his healing abilities is that he makes his body available for higher beings to use. And a lot of healers say that they don't attribute their healing abilities to themselves, but they become possessed, either temporarily or permanently or symbiotically, as you were saying, by higher beings who, through them, you know, carry out these healing activities. So that's it's something that's quite common, especially among traditional cultures. You often see that in, you know, in accounts of shamanism and things like that, that the shamans or the mystics or the healers or the visionaries, they attribute their powers not to their own individual powers, but to their ability to set up, you know, relationships with higher beings who act through them. Or, as you mentioned, sometimes there are also these lower kinds of beings as well. You know, it's not that all the beings in the cosmic hierarchy are angelic. There are definitely other types as well.
Yeah, we know also from the same history that there are higher beings, not the least of which is the Nephilim, that don't have the best interests of human beings on their minds. They want to do something else.
Well, yes, and I mean, this is something from the ancient Indian wisdom tradition, you know, from a book called the Mahabharata, which describes a war that took place, you know, thousands of years ago between the forces of good and evil. And it describes that before the war took place, beings of the positive and negative character from different levels of the cosmos deliberately managed to take birth in the families of human beings so that they could participate in this war and try to determine the outcome of it. Now, I mean, personally, I believe that the forces of good are dominant in the universe. You know, so I'm not a what you would call a somebody who's involved in cosmic paranoia, although I do recognize there are forces of darkness in the cosmos who are trying to influence the way things go on Earth and elsewhere in the cosmos. I think ultimately the forces of good are in control and are always in the end going to triumph. But but yes, those kinds of things are there, that sometimes these beings from different levels of the cosmos, of either, you know, from the forces of darkness or the forces of light, they try to influence events on Earth by taking birth in human families. I think that happens. Are we still online? Brooke?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I had a cord come out. I must have kicked the extension cord.
Okay.
My question is, you know, this consciousness that obviously exists in these intelligent beings, whether they are good or whether they are ill, It when they're not in the body, it's pure consciousness, right?
Yes, if it's because the consciousness is ultimately really pure. It's like if you have a light source and then you put different filters over it. Say if you have a pure white light bulb, then you can put a red filter over it, a blue filter over it. You can put more and more filters over it until practically the light will just disappear. You won't see anything.
Right.
Now, if you could take away all the filters, you'd see that it was a pure light that was there.
Uh-huh.
So ultimately, the conscious self is pure. It is. But because of the different filters that are put over it, it comes out, you know, in a different way. But if you could remove all the filters, you'd see, okay. So I would say, like, a good person in this world is like someone who has a very light filter, so that most of the light is coming out. what we would call an evil person would be someone who's got very heavy filters, you know, over the light, so that what's coming out isn't as bright. Something like that.
Well, maybe also what's going in isn't as bright, but, you know, I agree with you that a person's situation in their life, in their mortal life, is almost 100% their choice. Now, I can see where, you know, it's easy for us to say that, living free in the United States in these last days, we can pretty much be anything we want to be. It's just a matter of wanting it, you know, bad enough and going for it. But obviously, in some countries, you could be born into slavery, you could be born into extreme oppression or extreme poverty, you know, out in the middle of nowhere with no communication. You wouldn't even know the rest of the world existed. So there is something to be said for the current circumstances of a being. But for the most part, the condition of the soul in the mortal body is the responsibility of that soul.
I agree with you on that, and I think we have to ask, well, why is it, you know, that some souls are put in a position where they have more freedom and ability to act, and why some are put in another position? I think that's also because of choices they made in their past lives.
Well, there you go.
Somebody who may have been very violent and oppressive to people in a past life may in this life find themselves in another position. Now, to me, that doesn't mean necessarily that I'm going to have a callous attitude towards people who find themselves in less fortunate positions. Because even if it's their karma, I would say, it is a result of choices that they made. Still, as a human being, no matter what position a person's in, it is my business, you know, to be compassionate, to try to help them. For example, if somebody's starving, I can understand, yes, the reason why they're in that position is because of something they may have done in their past life. But that does not relieve me from the responsibility of trying to help that person in this life.
Well, and
if you
think about it, too, in a past life, they may have chosen to come to this world in that impoverished state to help you learn the act of charity and compassion.
That's true. That is also true. That is a very nice way to look at it. But still, the result is I shouldn't be callous towards them. It may be exactly as you say, that situation is meant to teach me something.
Well, then it sort of gives you great compassion for the love someone would have to say, I will go to the earth and I will be that impoverished case that comes to you, that tests you to see if you have the compassion inside of you to help another. And if you fail, then you will have learned something. And if you succeed, you will have learned something. But I will be that one to go. Now you start having great respect, great gratitude for the person in their impoverished state that has come to you. So now you have a greater compassion for them.
Yeah, I think that does happen. There are cases in the ancient Sanskrit writings that describe situations like that. You know, for example, there's a story of a king once who was fasting, and he was performing, you know, this religious ritual that involved fasting for a long time. And then at the end of the ritual, at the end of the fasting, he was going to be allowed to take some food. So he fasted for a long time. At the end of the ritual, he was going to take some food. And then this very poor person came up to him. And, all right, although he was starving himself from having fasted for, you know, and this person just, not a nice person, but a very dirty, you know, kind of fallen person, that give me some food. So he gave the food. And then he fasted some more, and then again he was about to take, you know, his meal after the fast, and then another, you know, person came with, you know, some starving dogs, and you know, they came to the king and said, give me some food. You know, so he gave them the food. And this went on for some time. And then finally, after the third or fourth time, all the personalities came before him and revealed they were higher angelic beings that had come to Earth in those forms just to test him in the exact way that you said.
Wow.
Because it showed, well, his generosity. You know, he was just amazed that happened. So those kinds of things do happen, I think, not just theoretically in the sense that you're talking about, but I think they actually do happen, that sometimes we are tested like that. And it makes you start to wonder about the different situations that you find yourselves in this world.
Well, it also makes you wonder, is there an original conscious being who is the source of all source for individuals?
Well, I do believe that, and for many people it's a difficult concept these days, but how I try to explain it to some of the audience that I speak to is, you know, consciousness is individual and personal. And just like I'm conscious, you're conscious, I know what's going on in my life, you know what's going on in yours. We're personalities, we're individual, we dress differently, we have our different tastes. And so consciousness, as we experience it, is individual and personal. And to me, that suggests the source of all conscious beings must also be, you know, individual and personal. Which is, it's very logical. I think it explains a lot that, you know, that's where we come from. Our source as individual conscious beings is another individual conscious being. So yes, I do accept that. Some people, they have the idea that consciousness ultimately must be impersonal, that you sort of merge into some kind of pantheistic or a void sort of existence. But I don't accept that. I think we're always persons. We're always individual, and we always have a relationship with that supreme conscious being who goes by so many different names, so many different traditions.
Yeah. All right. So that's the ethereal existence of the individual personality, the individual human being. You know, we've been taught in our schools that that modern man did not make his debut on Earth anywhere until about 250,000 years ago to maybe 7,000 years ago. It depends on which school you go to. What has the evidence revealed to you?
Well, when I started looking into this evidence for extreme human antiquity, I was very surprised, because what I found is that the evidence for a human presence goes all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. Now, for example, like the California gold mine discoveries. I mean, during the 19th century, miners went to California to get gold. They were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains to get the gold.
Right.
But in these tunnels, in a solid rock, they were finding human skeletons, not those of ape men, but of humans like us, along with all kinds of human artifacts. So these discoveries were made in layers of solid rock that belonged to the early part of the geological period called the Eocene, which means they would be about 50 million years old. I mean, not the 200,000 years that you were speaking about, which is a common idea today. So it's really quite amazing. The evidence was collected by J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. Now Whitney is named after him. His report was published by Harvard University, but we don't hear very much about these discoveries today because of, you know, this process of knowledge filtration that I was mentioning earlier on in the show.
Well, where are the fossils today? I mean, if we got the 50 million year old human bones, you're talking modern humans, right? Not Neanderthals, right?
Yes. Some of them, well, there were two things found. There were human bones and human artifacts. Now, I've seen some of the artifacts. Some of the artifacts, like stone mortars and pestles and things like that, they're kept in the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. And, you know, a few years ago, I was a consultant for a television special called Mysterious Origins of Man that was shown on NBC, hosted by Charlton Heston. And when the producer was filming that, I told him he should go to that museum, but the museum officials wouldn't let him see these artifacts.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Oh, it was amazing. And then when the show came out, you know, like, scientists tried to stop NBC from showing it, and they weren't successful. But then they went to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and they tried to get the FCC to punish NBC, fine NBC for having shown this program, because it contradicted everything they were saying to the children in the education system. So it was really quite amazing. But then, more recently, I was preparing a report about these discoveries that I presented as a paper at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress. And perhaps because of my connection with the World Archaeological Congress, the directors of the museum, they let me in to see these artifacts and photograph them. They're not kept in the museum itself. If you went to the museum, you'd never see them. They're kept in a storage building, you know, several miles from the museum. But I've personally seen, you know, these artifacts. Some of the bones were placed in the Philadelphia Museum of Natural History and the Boston Museum of Natural History, and sort of on my list to try to get to those museums and see if I can find, you know, get access to them, because I'd really like to see those as well. This is what I do, you know, as part of my research. I try to track all these things down.
Well, how many artifacts are we talking about? I mean, is this enough bones to fill a warehouse, or is it a fragment or two? Are we talking a toe bone or a whole skeleton?
According to the original reports from the California gold mines, some complete skeletons were found, some skulls, some fragments of bones. So there was quite a bit of material found. And if we look at all the other cases that I report, you know, in the book Forbidden Archaeology, we're not talking about just a few discoveries. If there were just one or two of these cases, you know, of evidence for extreme human antiquity, you know, you could always say, well, you know, so you got a few interesting cases, but most of the evidence supports, you know, the current theories. However, what I found in the 8 years of research that I did for this book, Forbidden Archaeology, is if you go back to the original scientific literature, not what you find in the textbooks, because that's edited, that's selected from out of the original scientific reports. But if you go back to the original scientific reports in archaeology, you find hundreds of cases where archaeologists, geologists, and other earth scientists have found evidence in the form of human bones, human footprints, and human artifacts going back tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of years. And it's not just a few. There are hundreds of them. It was enough to fill up a 900-page book. I mean, when I speak at universities to archaeology students, they're just amazed that there's such a huge body of evidence they've never even heard of before, not even to hear about it negatively. So it's not just a few cases that we're talking about. We're talking about a huge amount of evidence.
All right, let's go with that then. We're pretty sure, at least in cosmology, that there have been a number of cataclysms on the surface of the Earth, not the least of which was maybe the sinking of Lemuria and Atlantis, or how about the flood of Noah? I mean, there have been some pretty serious cataclysms on the surface of the Earth. Where do the populations of man go from the surface of the Earth when these kinds of things happen? Are there openings into the inner Earth?
It's very interesting. I agree with you. Yes, there have been periodic catastrophes on the surface of the earth. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak about these things. The ancient Sanskrit writings say time goes in cycles, and at the ends of cycles there are devastations after which the earth has to be repopulated.
Like in 2012.
Yeah, for example, the Sanskrit writings speak about a cycle of yugas, which means a cycle of ages. And there are four of these ages, and they're sort of like the, like you can say spring, summer, fall, winter, and then spring starts again. So it starts out with a golden age, and then things get a little more degraded, then a little more degraded, and in the final age, things get very degraded. And according to the ancient cosmological calendars of India, we're in one of those final ages, at the end of which there's going to be some destruction and catastrophe, after which the earth has to be repopulated.
Right.
But it says that even now, within the Himalayan mountains, there are refuges where there are personalities waiting, so that when it becomes time to repopulate the earth, they will emerge from these refuges, psychic refuges, you could say,
uh-huh.
and repopulate the earth. And, of course, the idea that we're part of a cosmic hierarchy of beings is also important, because that means that the elements for the repopulation, they could be at different levels of the cosmos, either
sure.
above or below our Earth level.
Right.
So there are sources of population other than just the Earth. But in this particular case, there are accounts in the ancient Sanskrit writings of people, populations, waiting now in these secret refuges within the Himalayan mountains. And I don't think they're the kinds of things that you would see if you were just walking through the mountains. I mean, you would have to have some special kind of spiritual access or something to get into these refuges. But apparently there are populations there now waiting for these devastations, after which they will repopulate the earth.
So it takes a special consciousness, a special preparation in order to be able to, well, maybe A, be admitted into it, and B, to even be aware of it.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I think there are many regions of the earth that we don't have access to in terms of ordinary consciousness.
Yeah, I know exactly what that's like. In preparing for this expedition next summer, we could just pile a bunch of scientists on this boat and take off, but so many advisors have said, no, there's a lot more to it than that. If you're going to see anything, it could be dimensional in nature, or it could be veiled somehow, and so you really have a dire responsibility on you to try to get their consciousness of this ship to the point where you'll be able to see anything. So this is a really challenging expedition.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, Michael, there's no better person on the planet we'd love to have along for those 13 days than you. And if you've got the opening, I'll talk to you off the air about becoming involved. It doesn't cost anything, but it would be that'd be a great research expedition there.
Okay, we'll talk about it, definitely.
All right. In our final 5 minutes, you mentioned that... That some of these discoveries go back hundreds of millions of years. Do you think that maybe one of these, in the very, I don't know how what the Earth would have looked like 600 million years ago, but is there evidence of human existence on the Earth, modern human existence going back that far?
Well, yes. For example, one case from the scientific literature, it comes from a scientific journal called The Geologist, which was published in the year 1862.
Uh-huh.
And it told of an anatomically modern human skeleton that was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County, Illinois, in the state of here in the United States. And according to the report, directly above the skeleton was a thick layer of unbroken slate rock that extended for a long distance in all directions. And that's sort of important, that this unbroken layer of rock was above the skeleton, because one of the usual skeptical counter explanations when you find a human skeleton in some very ancient layer of rock is that it must have arrived at that position by some kind of earth movement or fissure or burial kind of activity. So the fact that you've got a solid unbroken layer of rock, of slate rock, above the layer where the skeleton was found rules out that possibility.
Right. And
now,
what was the age of the rock above him?
Yeah, we sent some information to the Geological Survey of Illinois asking them how old the layer of rock below the slate rock was at that place. And they said about 300 million years.
Oh, my goodness.
So that would mean you've got evidence for a human presence going back 300 million years. And there's evidence that goes back even further as well.
Absolutely fascinating. And all of it found in the book, Forbidden Archaeology. You say the book is 900 pages long?
That's right. It's also available in a shorter edition called The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is about 300. But it seems that most people, they want all the details, so they
get
the bigger book. I was kind of surprised. I thought more people would want the shorter edition, but it's like people go for the bigger edition because they want all the facts.
Yes, yeah, we want all the facts, even if it. I have in our possession the book Gravitation, which is really an impressive black book with white writing on it. That's good to leave on your coffee table in case you have friends coming over. But it would take a lifetime, I think, to go through it. I don't know. I think it's maybe 1,000 pages long. But it's every single physics aspect that you can think of, even astrophysics, all the way to quantum mechanics, to the most macro view of the expansion of the universe. It's in this book. And it's all facts. And there's no story to it. You just have to digest everything. Mm-hmm. It's several PhDs between its covers, to be sure. So I'm definitely going to pick up the book, Forbidden Archaeology. De-evolution was absolutely fascinating. I listen to it even on audio when I get a chance, when I'm doing other things and multitasking, because I find the book so fascinating, and I'm overjoyed that you wrote it, grateful that you wrote it, and even more grateful that you were willing to come on the radio program and talk about it.
Oh, my pleasure, entirely.
Oh, I'm humbled because we have had a little bit of technical difficulties tonight, but we always overcome, and we have a tendency to go a little bit past the imagination of most people, but that's okay. They're safe here. We always return to ground zero or thereabouts when we get finished. Are there any questions that you have for me in the last 3 minutes of the program?
Well, that's something. I've never had a radio talk show announcer ask me that question.
I know.
I'm totally unprepared for that. But
well,
what's going forward with you? Are you working on another book?
Oh yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm actually here in East Tennessee using two strings and a can to get on the radio, working with my co-author E.J. Clark. We are just now putting the finishing touches on book number 3, the final book in the Ark of Millions of Years series. This one wraps everything up for the 2012 end times, and it's called, of course, the Ark of Millions of Years volume 3, but the subtitle is Unlocking the Secret. So we're really proud of the work, and we're trying to keep it under 500 pages, but I don't know if we're going to win the battle or not. It's a tremendous book. I've been working on the research for a little over 17 years, and my co-author for 35 years, and it's just hard to digest all of that into 3 books. The first book was about 530 pages, the second one about 430 pages, and this one will round it out. So it's a good series, and people would really do well in religious and historical and archaeological overview of the origin and destiny of the earth and humankind.
Well, that's really great. I think there are a lot of us who are moving kind of like in a parallel direction.
Well, there's no doubt about it. The information is just poured out of the universe, and those people that are in tune with it will take it and do something with it. are producing these landmark works, and it's not a small library of work, is it?
No, it isn't. I think we're kind of in one of those periods in Europe's intellectual history when we're seeing a fundamental change in worldview taking place right before our eyes. So I hope so.
We're coming up on a critical election year, I think. Michael, it's been my pleasure, and I can't wait to meet you at the UFO Expo in San Francisco.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, my friend, you have yourself a good evening, and we'll see you then. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth explorers, that you are source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth explorers.